nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
The thing which I posted, it's as you probably realize, there are two lectures on metamaterials which I'm going to give. And then the next one on clocking, which will be given by students, it's very much related to that. I mean, it's just like one of the manifestations. All right, let's start this subject. It's actually a very fascinating one. It doesn't happen in science that often when scientists have this luxury to revise the very basics of any particular science, the fundamentals, if not revise, at least to rethink of the fundamentals of a particular field of science. But in this particular case, perhaps it would be also appropriate to say to revise some of those too. And this is one of the latest and perhaps the most exciting development in the number of fields. It involves optics, photonics, nanophotonics, materials, engineering, and has to do with this what we call now metamaterials. Let me first start with defining what we mean by these metamaterials. That's actually will be given on the next slide. Therefore, let me, before we move in there, say a couple of words why I believe that this field is really that much exciting, because things like bringing refractive index into a new domain of negative values, which people, well, never considered seriously, at least most of us, that certainly does fascinate us. I mean, that brings entirely new way to control light, and indeed entirely new applications. Or things like having magnetism at optical frequencies, which also people believed was absolutely impossible. All these things actually have been rethought, and people believe that, yes, we can have now magnetism at optical frequencies, which is a very, very fascinating thing for a large number of applications. And yes, we can have a refractive index with negative values, again, which opens absolutely new and exciting opportunities to control light and to develop entirely new devices. And so I call this metamaterials giving light the second hand. I explain it in the course of my presentation what they mean by this. But basically, by enabling metamaterial, that's what we do. We completely change, not completely, but significantly change the way light interacts with materials. So we really touch the very fundamentals. So I want you to be part of this very exciting field, and I hope I will be able to convince you how interesting the physics behind that and how many new things might come out of this field eventually. So this is the outline of these two lectures which I'm going to present on this subject. I defined this metamaterial. Then I discussed two basic components of this metamaterial, those which interact in the way we want with electrical component of light, and we call them electric metamaterials, and those which interact with the magnetic component of light in a way which was unthinkable in the past, and we call those magnetic metamaterials. So, and these two actually enable negative index metamaterials. In other words, materials which have a negative refractive index. And one of the most famous and probably exciting applications of that is so-called perfect lens or super lens. And actually, this particular field is developing right now. I mean, I'm not able to include everything what is going on in this field, because like last week or week before that, there are new papers with absolutely exciting ideas about this perfect lens coming out. They now call it hyperlens. My friend from Princeton just did this wonderful work. Unfortunately, I just simply didn't have time to include that, because it's like really a couple, 3 weeks ago was done. So things develop here really exponentially. And I just provide a very short introduction to one of the most fascinating things, I would say, which is the border between real and fantastic. It sounds like almost absolutely impossible. When I said this to my daughter, she said to me, "Stop kidding me, Dad." looks like that's going to be also possible to make objects invisible and with these metamaterials, at least in principle, theoretically. So it's clear how to solve fundamental problems. It's not clear yet how to solve engineering problems. But I want you to appreciate the statement, and I hope you agree with me. There are fundamental problems. Like, for example, you really cannot send information with light, with the speed larger than the speed of light. And there are technical problems. So in this case, looks like fundamental problems at least can be solved. So theoretically, it's possible to clock objects. Well, the next step is basically to develop right materials, to find right design, to fabricate, and to prove the rest of the world that, hey, here we go, we can do clocking. And all these things, actually, what we are working in my lab, and there are a number of other groups. It's getting extremely popular now. There are a number of groups all over the world which work on different aspects of that. Okay, what is metamaterial? As I promise you, I'm going to define this. Metamaterials basically are engineered materials. They are typically composite materials. In other words, they consist of several components. And they can be tailored for specific application, for specific electromagnetic properties that cannot be found in nature. So therefore, they're called meta, because meta in Greek means beyond. Beyond the conventional. If you, those of you who is familiar with history, like several centuries ago, like people called metaphysics, meaning going beyond conventional physics. So some famous textbooks actually have this title. So that's what I think it's a very appropriate title actually for this field, metamaterials, because these are really new materials. They have properties which are unattainable with materials existing in nature. So that's what makes them so sexy. If you look at the conventional material, which is built of atoms, so that's what we have. Okay, now what we do, we design a meta-atom, some structure which is bigger than atom and has already certain functionality, different from the functionality of atom. We're not happy with what atoms can do. I mean, they can do lots of things, but some things, like, for example, they cannot interact with magnetic component of light in the optical range. So, therefore, we design atoms, making them bigger, much smaller than the wavelengths, but bigger. This is one of our design, actually, coming from our group, these two parallel rods, which, for example, enable this interaction with the magnetic component of light, which does not occur for conventional atoms, or it's just simply too small to consider it. So that's meta-atom. So meta-material is built of artificially designed atoms which have special properties for specific applications. All right, we need to place meta-materials in terms of how they're compared to other well-known materials. Well, let's say most of conventional materials, crystals, well, you name it, semiconductors, dielectrics, metals, all these materials, gases in many cases. So they have the common thing there is the size of the atom is much smaller than the wavelengths. Okay, and in this case, we describe these materials, I'm speaking of electromagnetic properties of materials, by using these four material characteristics, which are magnetic permeability, mu, which characterizes interaction with magnetic component of light, dielectric permittivity, epsilon, which characterizes interaction with the electrical component of light, how materials is responding to the electrical component of light. And these two, which are, can be expressed in terms of mu and epsilon, which are refractive index and impedance. So these, you can use N and Z or M and epsilon. It's just, this is more like they can be expressed in terms of each other. And that's what we call optical crystals. How it turns out that metamaterials are also in this range of sizes. For metamaterial, the size also is much smaller than the wavelengths, but much larger than the atom, or size of atom or molecule, because we basically fabricate this structural units of metamaterial. Therefore, typical sizes, when we speak of metamaterial for a structural units, it's say something between 5 nanometers to 300 nanometers. So it's smaller than the wavelengths, but much larger than atom. And it's designed and fabricated. So there is another very important class of materials which we have considered, and those called photonic crystals, and where the size of the structural units is comparable to the wavelengths. To the same class also belong other things like phased array radar. It's just a different range of the wavelengths, but it actually works in the same way. The certain size involved in the system is matches the wavelength. So let's say X-ray diffraction optics. In that case also, the period is related to the wavelengths. Well, in the context of this particular course, I guess the most relevant to us is these photonic crystals. And I emphasize many times that photonic crystals are actually wonderful structures, but the properties, their properties kind of determined mainly by diffraction and interference. Okay, that's so there is multiple scattering, there is diffraction, interference, and you have these wonderful ways to manipulate light. But again, the whole operation is kind of related to the wavelengths. So therefore, the size of the structural unit should be related to the wavelengths. Finally, of course, there are a big class of materials which have the size of the structural unit much larger than the wavelengths. And in this case, we can use geometrical optics to describe light. And that, of course, includes all these optical systems, such as lens, when we look shadows, whatever. Any, let's say, what we see with eyes, it's typically belongs to this class, geometrical optics. And we can describe it by tracing rays. All right, so again, this is the size of your system as compared to the wavelengths. And metamaterials fill into this group. But I still want to emphasize they're different from conventional crystals. That's actually what this couple slides illustrate. If you look at natural crystals, where, of course, the size of atom is much smaller than the wavelength, but it consists of atoms. The typical things about crystals, they have lattice constants much smaller than the light wavelengths. Okay, that they do belong to the class. And they can be treated as a homogeneous media with parameters epsilon, mu, and z. In the case we are dealing with anisotropic crystals, we have actually these characteristics become tensors. They are not scales. All these natural crystals have positive refractive index. Okay, that's very important because metamaterials, what they make unique, they can have refractive index negative. And if you look at the magnetic response of all natural crystals, there is no such thing. So at optical frequencies, all natural materials have mu equal 1, period. There is no interaction with the magnetic component of light, which means that when it comes down to the optical range, light is handicapped. It has two components, electrical and magnetic, but it interacts with all natural materials only with the electrical component. The magnetic is not used. I mean, with atoms, so. And there is a good reason for that, which we will discuss. I mean, maybe it's not a good reason, but there is some fundamental reason why it happens. So, and metamaterials enable a very important thing. They allow interaction to the other hand of light, which is the magnetic component. So light then can probe materials with both hands. It can couple two materials with both its hands, electrical component and magnetic component. So that probably should give you a flavor how important these metamaterials, because the whole interaction becomes entirely different. Clearly, the interaction with the magnetic component in the optical range should bring lots of new physics into the game, and it does. So, well, I mentioned this photonic crystal. Here are some examples. This beautiful structure actually made of silicon. And it's done by my friend Vlasov at IBM. Look how beautiful it is. You see, it's a periodic array of these holes drilled in silicon. And they do wonderful things with this structure. They make these photonic wire, like they make actually like a line defect and the guide light in these photonic crystals. It's everywhere periodic, but if you make it in some place, just remove, let's say, array of holes, then you can guide along this with very, very low losses. So photonic crystals is a wonderful, fascinating field, and this is a beautiful design and fabricated structure. As opposed to metal materials, photonic crystals do have lots of structures, or let's say creatures, existing in nature. In this case, you can see a butterfly, and all these wonderful colors associated with butterfly actually originates from the fact that there are photonic crystal-like structures there. You can see now, if you look at the with the microscope, you can see this beautiful periodical structure, different periodical structure which diffract light in a different way and provide all this wide spectrum of beautiful wild colors. So, as I pointed out, that they can be artificial or natural. They have properties which mainly governed by the diffraction of the periodic structures. And why they're so important? Because they may exhibit a band gap for photons. That's what allows this guiding. Remember that if you make a defect, that light cannot go into the structure because of the band gap, but can propagate only along the defect. That's the idea. Therefore, it's so important to have a band gap. Yeah.
So when we talk about vacuum, we always have this 1/2 h bar omega of energy, the 0.0.
Right. Yes.
So in the photonic band gap, do we have that, or is it like more of a true vacuum?
That's actually a good point, a good question, and we didn't discuss it. In photonic crystals, the electromagnetic vacuum which you mentioned, of course, it does exist, but it wildly modified. Because as opposed to the free space where all modes are available, in a photonic crystal, let's say if you place, for example, atom, and if you look at the frequency at which coincides with the band gap, which is within the band gap, it cannot emit at all. You can control spontaneous emission, and spontaneous emission, the electromagnetic vacuum, zero-point fluctuations. That's exactly what they do. They control spontaneous emission. In a photonic crystal, you can modify the properties of spontaneous emission wildly. You can slow down it significantly, or you can actually accelerate spontaneous emission. So the point is, with photonic crystals, you can engineer the electromagnetic vacuum to a large extent. So that's another huge application of photonic crystals, which unfortunately we didn't cover within this course. That has to do with quantum optics. And the bottom line is, you modify not only conventional classical electromagnetic modes, you also modify modes of the electromagnetic vacuum of zero-point fluctuations. And by doing that, you dramatically can change the very basic things such as spontaneous emission. I wish we had time for that, but that's a beautiful thing. All right, and typically photonic crystals cannot really describe properly in terms of this epsilon and mu, because this epsilon mu, which enter this Maxwell's equation, they result of certain averaging, and you can make averaging over the size much larger than the structural unit, but much smaller than the wavelengths. But in this case, the structural unit is exactly matches the wavelengths. So in most cases, with some exceptions, epsilon mu refractive index are not really good characteristics to describe photonic crystals, simply because the size of the structure, the lattice period, matches the wavelengths. They often behave like metamaterials. Maybe some people would not be happy with this statement, and I often review articles actually on this subject. So photonic crystals do demonstrate properties very similar to those of metamaterials I'm about to consider, but in some sense they are not true metamaterials, because the size of the lattice period is relevant to the wavelengths. So for example, with photonic crystal, you can send a ray in the direction which would correspond to the negative diffraction, but you never can do true super lensing, because it just essentially you already have lattice period related to the wavelength. Therefore, you cannot get resolution much smaller than the wavelength because your material is built of a structure essentially inherently relevant to the wavelength. So they are very nice, and many people treat them as metamaterials, but I would do it in quotes. They are very special. They are special class. I mean, if you wish to call them metamaterials, then it's a special class of metamaterials, which you better call biot photonic crystals. All right, so, and again, to emphasize that that what we are considering now is important, and to place properly different materials, let me show this famous diagram. I guess first Sir John Penry put it in his review article. So it's so-called epsilon mu diagram. So what it shows here, mu and epsilon, when they have positive or negative numbers. And for now, we concentrate on the real parts of this epsilon mu. They also have imaginary parts related to losses, but for now, let's concentrate on the real parts. Most of materials we know belong to this class, where both epsilon and mu are positive. In other words, the dielectric displacement goes with the applied electrical field, and with magnetic induction goes with the applied magnetic field. So if they are both positive, then if you look at the propagation of a wave, and any wave can be described propagation by this, IKZ, but K is simply refractive index times omega over C. Okay, that's what is K. And now recall that refractive index in term is the square root of epsilon mu. Refractive index squared is equal epsilon times mu, as follows from the Maxwell's equation. Okay, it means that the refractive index is just square root of the product. If both epsilon mu positive, everything is fine. We have a square root of a positive number. We get positive number. Refractive index is positive number. And we have this plane wave-like propagation. And we know that light propagates through glass or other dielectrics. There are different type of glass materials, such as those which have mu negative, but mu positive, but epsilon is negative. And those are metals. We spend so much time considering metals, and we said that metals have wonderful properties. They can focus light down to nanoscale, you can manipulate light on nanoscale, and that all because they have this negative epsilon. But mu is indeed positive. Well, let's think what it implies in terms of propagation of waves. If epsilon is negative and mu is positive, then the product of the two becomes a negative number, which means now you have a square root of negative number, and square root of a negative number is equal minus I, okay, or J, as you say, engineers say. So, and when you multiply square root of minus one, minus negative, square root of minus one is equal I, okay, I'm confused myself, square root of, just for simplicity, okay, we can say that epsilon equal minus one, mu is equal one, square root of minus one is equal I, and I times I gives you minus. It means that wave would exponentially decay inside of a material. And that's indeed the case. Light doesn't penetrate into metals. It gets reflected. Therefore, any metal works like a mirror. I mean, we can see ourselves looking at the mirror. So this mirror actually has this thin metal film. That's why we can see our reflection. So light doesn't penetrate into metal. It penetrates only into very thin layers, called skin layers, and skin depth is in the optical range is typically 20 nanometers. So then it gets expelled. Light is expelled. It exponentially decays and reflected. So that's the class where a mu is positive but epsilon is negative. Okay, in principle, there are such materials, but not at high frequencies, where mu is negative but epsilon is positive, so-called magnetic plasma. It does exist, but as I said, it's kind of at relatively low frequencies. In this case, you have the same story. The product of positive and negative number, you would give you negative number, square root of negative number gives you I times something. So you again have exponential decay. So you again have this evanescent waves. In this case also, electromagnetic wave cannot penetrate into such a material. However, the story entirely changes if both epsilon and mu are negative. Then the product of two negative numbers becomes a positive number, and we actually return to this case, but not exactly. It turns out that if both epsilon and mu are negative, then yes, you have a positive number under the square root, and then you get the real number. The square root is the real number, but you have to take the sign I, the sign minus here. That's actually very easy to show if I find the chalk. Well, I guess you could just follow with me. Let's say that both epsilon and mu are equal minus 1. Okay, let's replace the square root of the product by the product of square roots. Then you have square root of minus 1 times square root of minus 1, which means I times I, and I times I is equal minus. So my point is that if both epsilon and mu are negative, you have to take the sign minus here. So yes, now you have a real number here. I mean, the wave does propagate, but refractive index becomes negative. So that's my statement, that when you have both epsilon and mu negative, material becomes transparent. Electromagnetic wave can propagate through, but the properties become very different because refractive index becomes negative, and we will see in what sense it becomes different. So as opposed to the cases when only one of the two characteristics is negative and another is positive, when waves basically are evanescent, exponentially decay, do not propagate through material, there are two cases when wave can propagate through material. One of those which describes most of conventional materials when they're both positive, and another one, which in a sense is new, and that's what we're going to focus on, is when they're both negative. So in this case, again, the square root is just real number. So a wave can propagate through such a material, but in a different way because refractive index becomes negative. Well, it comes down to very simple things, actually. You could understand lots of things just by looking at simple oscillator. And as I pointed out many times, it's simple oscillator. It's a very good model of atom, actually. So normally, if the frequency of driving force, let's say, of electrical field, and let's look at the dipole response of atom. So if you're slightly below the resonance, so then what typically happens that the dipole moment is looking in the same, the induced dipole moment looks in the same direction as the applied field. So, and the dipole, and that's the positive response. If you go far away from the resonance in either way, then again the response is positive, saying that by meaning that the dipole moment looking in the same direction as the electrical field, however, it's of course small because you're far away from the resonance. However, if you're only slightly above the resonance here, then what could happen that the dipole moment, the induced dipole moment, looks against the electrical field. And that's eventually that's what comes down to this negative response. But of course, there are many other things to be fulfilled to have this negative response on the macroscopical scale. So, but this is just illustrates that on the in terms of individual atoms, this negative response has to do with the fact that you have to be a little bit above the resonance, and then you can realize the situation when the response is actually against the applied field. Okay, let's consider some examples of electrical metamaterials. And so the first one to look at is just a metal, conventional metal. And metal can be described by this Drude formula, which we considered. The Drude formula, in turn, could be thought of as just as a harmonic oscillator with restoring frequency equals zero. If you take a model of conventional harmonic oscillator, but set the restoring force, fundamental frequency equals zero, you get the Drude model. So that's it. Because Drude model describes free electrons, no restoring force. So we should accept this constant, which has to do with interband transitions. And this term, which is describes the contribution of free electrons, it's basically like oscillator with no, let's say if you take a spring and set the spring constant equals zero, you get free spring. So, and that's described by Drude model. So, and if you look at electrons, if there is no restoring force, if they're not bound to a nuclei, then they are free to move. And so that's the formula which describes electrons. And for Silo, for example, that's a parameters which characterize this epsilon node in the optical range, which gives contribution through the interband transition. It almost doesn't depend on frequency in the, let's say, in the visible range, in the broad range. Omega P is the plasma frequency. It's a very important characteristic. It's proportional to the density number of free electrons, mass of electrons, inversely proportional. So and that's a very important characteristic. And typically for noble metals, it's actually around 9 eV. For gold, for silver, it's about the same. And gamma, which characterizes the decay rate of these free electron excitations, is for silver, it's 0.02 eV. Okay, and if you plot now this Drude formula against the experimental data, you see the fit is nearly the perfect. The experimental data is taken from this by Johnson and Christie, that's paper. So you see that that's the real part, you see it's very negative. And as I said, to these metamaterials, they are kind of about negative things. So with metamaterials, we should be very positive about negative. So that's all what metamaterials are about. And so it's, you see, it's not just negative, it's huge. It's like minus 200 at around 1.5 micron telecommunication wavelengths. It's about 100, minus 100. That's huge. And remember that if we would be able to introduce a refractive index somehow here, and it turns out you can, and it's square root of epsilon, and we're dealing here with 100, with epsilon like 100, that actually enables so-called surface plasmon microscope, which Jian is going to talk about, this very large epsilon, which eventually could be treated as large refractive index, and therefore the wavelengths associated with surface plasmon are very short. And the imaginary part, of course, is significant, but much smaller than the real part. Okay, you have this, you can actually, it turns out you can control the plasma frequency, and the plasma frequency is a very important parameter. Let me come back here, because you can see that when omega becomes less than some plasma frequency, then this term becomes really negative. Well, I'm sorry, then this term can be this positive one. So omega has to be smaller than omega p to be this positive epsilon naught and to make a epsilon naught negative eventually. All right, so can we control omega p? It turns out yes. So if you take this a mesh of wires, metal wires, it turns out you can treat this system as still as a metal, but kind of diluted metal, because the concentration of electrons in space here becomes smaller, because in some parts of space you do have metal and some you do not. So you could treat it as kind of effective metal, but it's very diluted density number of electrons. And as a result of that, the plasma frequency becomes much smaller. It's not 9 eV anymore. Actually, it depends on the ratio of C, where is C actually? Well, C is light speed, sorry. It's with the ratio of R, where R is the radius of the wire, and A, where A is the period. So if you take, let's say, A large, meaning that you really dilute it a lot, then the plasma frequency can be quite small. C here is the light speed, by the way. So it's not the whole story. The whole story turns out that there is also self-induction effect, and because of this self-inductance, so what happens? Electrons kind of slow down in their motion, and they behave as effectively they would have much larger mass, and that also lowers the plasma frequency. So there are two factors: one, you dilute the metal. And another one, electrons move more slowly in a way because of the self-inductance effect. And that could be treated as effectively they have larger mass. We are not going to go into details, but the point is, in this case, you have dramatically reduced the plasma frequency. You can actually move it to the microwave. And you can control it by controlling the density of this metal, simply changing the period of your mesh. So what we're considering here is a periodical array of these metal wires with this lattice, which is the period much smaller than the wavelengths. It is a true metamaterial in that sense, but it's much larger than the size of a single wire. So it can be described in terms of this effective epsilon, and it does look like the Drude formula. But the important thing now, you can actually control the plasma frequency. And you control it by geometry. Well, this is my my previous love, and I decided to mention it briefly. It has to do with fractals. I have been working on fractals for actually quite for a number of years. And they also are beautiful metamaterials, but random ones. We're a little bit obsessed lately with designing and fabricating all these smart structures. But for a number of applications still, it turns out that random structures such as fractals provide unbeatable properties. For example, for sensing, for enhancement of local fields, still the largest effects can be obtained with these fractal structures. Let me just very briefly mention them. So in this case, what makes fractals fractals is the self-similarity, okay? If you look at this form, you can see that the structure of the whole is repeated on a progressively smaller scale. Like this structure is actually the same as this structure, but it's just built of smaller structural units. If you now take a smaller piece of that, that would also have the same structure. If you to look with a microscope with a stronger resolution on this small part of that, it would look exactly the same. That's what fractals are. They are self-similar. They reproduce the structure of the whole on a progressively smaller scale. But this is a geometrically ordered fractal. But there are also fractals which reproduce statistically the structure of the whole. Like in this case, actually, it's Colorado River Delta. And without indicating the scale, you cannot say actually how big it is. Is it miles or this is, let's say, tens of meters? Because the structure is self-similar. If I look at this small piece of that, it would look again as a whole, statistically. And actually, in turn, it looks very much like trees, by the way, which are also fractals. So there are so many structures in the world which are so much appealing to our eyes, which are fractals. Because frankly, human beings, it's kind of our nature. We don't like these cubes. I mean, it's kind of boring to our eyes. So I said, clouds, rivers, trees, rocky mountains, they're all fractals. There's so much beauty about fractals, by the way. Fractals are something in between perfectly geometrically ordered, which is, in my opinion, quite boring often, and complete disorder. Like if I scatter salt on the surface of this table, that would be complete chaotic system. It's also not that pleasing, right? Fractals is something in between. There is certain order, certain symmetry there, which is scale invariant, self-symmetry. And it turns out that it's really kind of appeals to our eyes. It's when it was really very popular, this topic, people would have these exhibitions moving from one city to another one where they, with computers, create different fractals, and people would stand in front of these pictures of fractals, and they just look, wow, it's so beautiful. And I think it is beautiful, but those coming from nature are particularly beautiful. So this is a fractal colloid aggregate which we make in our lab, and it's built of these silver nanoparticles, which are 10 nanometer in size. Why it's actually fractal? Any section of this structure has a hole comparable in size to the section itself. Let me illustrate my point. Let's consider this section. You see, it has a hole, a void, which is of the same scale as this particular section. And it's true, let's say I take like much, much smaller section, this one. Again, there is a void of the same scale. If you take the whole cluster, there is a void of the same scale. It turns out if you calculate the number of particles as a function of the size, for all conventional media, gases, liquids, crystals, it increases as size raised to the power of 3, where 3 is simply the space, the dimension of our space. For fractals, for this particular fractal, that exponent would be equal 1.75. So they have fractional dimension. They are like exist in fractional space. Therefore, they're called fractals. So it's a beautiful subject. I mean, I was fascinated with this for a number of years. And the properties are absolutely great. Like, for example, if you excite this fractal with light, it turns out that and it consists of these metal particles. Instead of being spread over the whole structure, it's concentrated in these so-called hot spots, which, let's say, 10 to 100 nanometer in size, where the local field can exceed the applied field by 6 orders of magnitude. Not the local field, sorry, the intensity, local intensity. And it's concentrated on this 10 nanometer scale. And I'm bringing this example purposely because people now design all these structures, smart structures, nano-antenna to get the same type of concentration and enhancement. To make these colloidal aggregates, it costs, I don't know, 10 cents, whatever. It's nothing. And you get this wonderful concentration of energy and huge enhancement. This is also metamaterial because it's built of structures much smaller than the wavelengths. And it has dramatically enhanced electrical response. Very interesting one. But this is kind of random metamaterial. And just a few more words. It's another example of this random metamaterials. It's so-called percolation film. What that is about, if you deposit metal on a glass substrate, just simply evaporate metal, let's say, on glass, or it could be another insulator. At small filling factors, you have these isolated granules of metal. So when you increase the metal filling factor, coalescence occurs, and you have these irregularly shaped clusters. And at some point, at some metal filling factor, which is called percolation threshold, you have a continuous path from one end of the sample to another one. And that's called percolation threshold, because if you apply the voltage, now the current go through. You have a phase transition. At this point, the whole structure is insulated with respect to DC voltage. Here, it's a conductor. And when you have a phase transition, geometrical phase transition, you always should expect very unusual properties, and they are. It turns out that this percolation system can also be described in terms of fractals, basically like a combination of clusters of all different sizes. And if you consider, let's say, a particular cluster like this one, so the resonant frequency of this cluster, you could say that it has these metal elements which could be treated as inductance, and inductance is proportional to the length of the cluster. And it has a gap which has positive epsilon, therefore it should be treated as a capacitance, also proportional to length. So the resonant frequency would go like 1 over L. So that no matter what is the wavelengths, you always would find such clusters which resonated that wavelengths. And you have these beautiful hotspots. And we actually developed new sensors called adaptive metal film based entirely on these percolation films. And because they produce these strong hotspots, you can actually do sensing of various proteins and other biological molecules. This is an example of random metamaterial. I mean, as I said, people kind of prefer to speak of geometrically ordered metamaterials. But it's not only beautiful, actually, that provide fantastic properties. And they're very cheap to fabricate normally. It's not e-beam fabricating or something like that. They're chemically done. They're very simple and very efficient. Like for sensing, they are very good. Okay, let's move to magnetic metamaterials. All right, here is the problem, which I already mentioned. If you look at all natural magnetics, in terms of their resonant frequency, they do not go beyond few gigahertz. All magnetic resonances are relatively low. They don't go to the optical range. Also, there is no magnetic monopole, therefore there is no magnetic plasma, in a sense, built of these magnetic charges. And if you look at all conventional optics, we always set their mu equal 1. Every time we can see the light with conventional materials, we set mu equal 1. So what is the big reason behind that? Magnetic coupling to an atom. In other words, how strongly magnetic component of light interacts with atom is given by this Bohr magneton, which is EH over 2mc, which could be in turn expressed as alpha, where alpha is the fine constant, 1 over 137, times the charge times the Bohr radius. If you look at the electrical coupling to atom, this goes exactly like charge over electron times Bohr radius. So you see that the interaction to the magnetic component by factor alpha is smaller. The magnetic moment itself, so one thing is how strongly atom interacts with magnetic field. Another thing, the magnetic moment itself, it's also proportional to alpha, it turns out. Therefore, the resultant effect that magnetic response as compared to the electrical response is by factor alpha squared is small. And this is a huge small factor. That's exactly why I told you that light, when it comes down to the optical frequency, is handicapped. It has only one hand. It probes atoms with only one its hand, which is electrical component, and the interaction with magnetic component is very small. So because of that, if you look at the Bible of the theoretical physics, this course of theoretical physics written by Landau and Lifshitz, it's written the magnetic permeability ceases to have any physical meaning at relatively low frequency. There is, I should put here high frequency. There is certainly no meaning in using magnetic susceptibility from optical frequency onwards. And in discussion of such phenomena, we must put mu equal 1. So in the whole course of theoretical physics of Landau, by Landau, it's mu is equal 1. It turns out that it's not like it's a mistake, because they realize that to have mu different from 1, you have to deal with very small structures. But any small structure smaller than the wavelengths at that time, which people could think of, was just atom. And in atoms, for atoms, interaction with magnetic components is really small by alpha squared. So, however, if you design structures which would be smaller than the wavelength but much larger than the atom, and if you introduce some certain resonant properties into that structure, if you design your matter atom, then mu indeed can be different from 1. So, and in that sense, that's the way, and then you can enable interaction with the magnetic component of light. So how can we do it? Well, if you look at just a, let's say, bulk metal, like a small piece of metal, like a sphere of metal, then there is no magnetic response in optics. If you make a ring where you could have a current going through the ring, so you could get actually some magnetic response, but it would be very weak. If you make a split ring, make here a cut, then actually you could think of this is like inductance, because epsilon is negative, associated with metal, meaning that it corresponds to inductance. And here you have a gap where epsilon is positive, meaning that there is a capacitance. It could work as LC circuit, and it could have actually a magnetic response at the high frequencies. It turns out you can dramatically increase that magnetic response by having these two split ring resonators, one inside of each other. So then what you have in this case, you have capacitance associated with these two gaps, and also with this distance, with this separation between the two C's. And you have also inductive element associated with currents within these rings. So, and as proposed by Pendry in 1999, you can actually have a magnetic response in these split ring resonators, at least in the gigahertz range. And also at higher frequencies, up to terahertz. It turns out, actually, there were earlier papers than this, but because Pendry developed it in the context of metamaterials, it drew so much attention. But later, people realized that there were other works where these similar structures were proposed, actually, before. All right, so this is the standard, became kind of standard configuration, the split ring resonates. So how can we move them toward the high frequency? Well, the obvious idea, let's make them smaller. So when you make them smaller, then actually the frequency the inductance becomes smaller, capacitance becomes smaller, the frequency becomes smaller, because frequency is 1 over square root LC. But also the requirement to have this magnetic response, the magnetic moment should be perpendicular to this split ring resonator. So it's kind of... you have to place them kind of vertically, ideally. If light, let's say, is incident normally, then they should stand vertically, which is hard to fabricate. The first, actually, breakthrough in this area in terms of bringing magnetism into high frequencies was done by Shang Zheng from, at that time, UCLA. Now he's at Berkeley. So he used this E-beam fabricated two split ring resonators with typical scale like 1 micron. Of course, they were horizontally in plane. Okay, you cannot make them really standing up. But if you use this angular incidence, that certain component of the magnetic field does penetrate through the, is directed perpendicular to the split ring resonator, and therefore can induce the magnetic moment. So you see a small portion of H penetrates these split ring resonators and therefore induce magnetism. That was the first demonstration of magnetism at 1 terahertz, already world record. And I would like to draw your attention that all these developments actually occurred within the last 2 years. So So this is 2004. Everything what I'm going to talk now about is actually nearly the same time. It's all like last 2-3 years. Things develop here absolutely fast. So what were the next developments? It turns out that if you take actually not two, but one split ring resonator, like this one. You see, then even if you have the configuration like this, so that the magnetic field does not penetrate through this split ring resonator, and therefore you cannot induce the current. Okay. However, what happens in this case, the electrical component of light, it does induce the current, okay, for this horizontally placed split ring resonator. But the current is not fully compensated because you have here the cut, meaning that there is a net current here. And since there is a net current, you should induce mu. So this is a structure where the mu is induced not through the magnetic component of light, but through the electrical component of light. However, if you turn the C letter in this way, so then you induce these currents, and of course there would not be any net current. Okay, so there would not be any magnetic resonance in this case. So this structure was proposed by Sekulis, and so they actually said that you can have magnetic moment induced with the electrical component of light if you have even a single split ring resonator. And that was demonstrated by Karlsruhe group in 2004, and they obtained response in 100 terahertz. So you can look here that at around 3.5 or so micron, if you look at transmittance and reflectance, there is a strong resonance here for the light polarized like this, and for the light polarized like this, when there is no actually magnetic moment, there is no any resonance in this area. And if you actually retrieve magnetic moment from here, that it turns out that there is magnetic permeability, which is negative in the range of 3 micron. So another approach which was employed by Steve Brook at the University of New Mexico, he would make these staples. That's more traditional one, because in this case, if the wave is normal incident, then the magnetic component would penetrate through this structure as it's required. So the magnetic component can induce the current directly, not through the electrical field. So and he would place it above the actually metallic mirror. So and he would obtain magnetic response at around 60 terahertz. That was 2005. See, things developed before all that magnetism, which was known only for gigahertz range. Well, it turns out with these split ring resonators, there is a fundamental limit. You cannot really bring it to the visible range. And that has to do that inductance associated with these structures has the same part which is in you associate with coil, and that actually which occurs for, let's say, perfect conductor. And the one which is called kinetic, and which is associated with the fact that there is always some resistance to motion. And this goes like proportional to size. This goes like inversely proportional to size. And if you look, and capacitance is always proportional to size. So if you look at the resonant frequency, it turns out that when you decrease the size, the resonant frequency, of course, increases, but up to a certain point. And actually, you cannot really go beyond 0.9, 0.8 micron. So you cannot, by using split ring resonators, you cannot bring magnetism to the visible range. So we need to come with new design. And that's the design which comes from our group. We suggested it in 2002 with my former student Podolsky, who is now a professor at the University of Oregon, and Dr. Sarachev, who worked at that time in my group. So the idea we employed is just to take this pair of rods. And if you make a layer of pair of rods, like it's shown here, and let's say the light is incident normally to this structure, so the magnetic field penetrates through this pair, as it's shown here. And since it varies in time, there is varying in time magnetic flux, which means it induces, according to the Faraday's law, the current here. Okay, and within the metal rods, this current is actually just conduction current. Pay attention, this is asymmetric current. It's extremely important that the current in the roads goes in opposite directions. And this current is closed by the displacement current associated with these gaps. So within metals, epsilon is negative, meaning that there is inductance, L. And within the gaps, epsilon is positive, meaning there is a capacitance. And the displacement current associated with this dielectric gap is actually proportional to the frequency. When you move to the optical range, the displacement current becomes progressively larger. Usually you ignore displacement current in, let's say, at low frequency. Everything is described by the conduction current. In the optics, it plays a very important role. And we take advantage of the fact that at the high frequencies, you have very strong displacement current, which is comparable to the conduction current, and you have this LC circuit. So you have a closed loop of current, and as a result, you have mu, okay? Because magnetic moment associated with the current, with loop current. So that was the prediction. And in last year, we actually generalized this idea, and we said instead of having two roads, you have two strips by simply sliding them in XY plane. So the geometry is the same. So, but now instead of roads, you have strips parallel to each other. And it turns out that the magnetic response could be even stronger in this case. And this is a very recent result which we just submitted, actually. It's not even published yet. This is AFM picture. This is a field emission scanning electron microscope picture of these strips. Because of some fabrication peculiarities, the upper strip is actually slightly smaller in size. So you could see actually both the upper one and the bottom one. So, but they parallel each other. This is numerical simulations done by Alex Kildyshev and Uday Chetyar in my group. And you can see that blue means actually it's the magnetic component which penetrates through these strips. And blue corresponds to the applied field. And red means that it's actually the local magnetic field looks against the applied field, indicating that response is indeed negative. Okay, and here is this asymmetric current I'm talking about. There is a symmetric current, and there is induced magnetic field which looks against the applied field. And what we actually obtained when we compared transmission and reflectance experimentally observed with our simulations, you see that the agreement is very well. The bottom line is, we obtained first mu equal minus 1 at 770 nanometers according to the International Commission on Illumination. The visible is defined between 380 nanometers and 780 nanometers. I'm sure perhaps only half of you would be able to see that long wavelengths, but in principle it's still considered to be visible. But to feel more comfortable, we actually already modified the structure by making them slightly thicker. And the latest result, which I don't have even a plot here, the picture is not ready, it's mu equal minus 1.7 at 725 nanometers. That's quite red light, okay? So we now have the record, the old record, in terms of magnetism observed at the highest possible frequency. So we have magnetism observed at the red light, 725 nanometers. So that's new, that's exciting. Okay, so we have this wonderful electrical materials. We can have negative epsilon. We have materials which have negative mu. We should start thinking about making materials with negative refractive index, because you remember, to have this negative N, you want to have both epsilon and mu negative. And negative index materials, negative refractive index materials, really bring very interesting applications up, enable very interesting applications. Let me start with naming some very important people who contributed to this field. As often happens in the history of science, some new idea comes up, new in quotes, and people got so excited about this. Oh, this is revolutionary. And then you start looking into the past and something which was done long ago, sometimes a century ago. And you find out that they were giants, scientific giants, who would predict this or very relevant phenomena. But they were so much ahead of their peers that it wasn't even appreciated at that time. And that's exactly what happens with this area of metamaterials. I was very astonished to learn, it happened like 1 year ago, I was visiting the University of Colorado, and somebody showed me a textbook written in 1904 by Sir Arthur Schuster, who is a German a guy who spent most of his research career in the University of Manchester, who in the book is called Introduction to Optics. And it's not optics even. It's not like modern optics or, let's say, cutting edge optics or whatever. It's Introduction to Optics. And in his textbook, that's actually a quote from there. Energy can be carried forward at the group velocity, but in the direction that is anti-parallel to the phase velocity. If refractive index is negative, it means that the wave vector changes its direction. And wave vector gives you the direction of the phase velocity. So energy propagates in the direction of the group velocity, okay? So the pointing vector. But the phase velocity is related to the wave vector. The wave vector is proportional to the refractive index. If you change the sign of the refractive index, it means that the wave vector looks in the opposite direction with respect to the pointing vector, which implies that the group velocity and phase velocity are going in opposite direction. Sir Arthur Schuster, 1904. And Lamp actually considered very similar phenomenon, but for hydrodynamics, not for optics. There are also waves, and in the case of hydrodynamics, he considered also very similar phenomena. Russian physicist, brilliant physicist Mandelstam, in his lectures at Moscow State University, just basically draw the pictures with negative refractive index showing the rays propagate in these wrong directions. He considered in quite details. And by the way, this same man, he discovered what we call now Raman scattering. In Russia, we are not allowed to say Raman scattering. We say combinational scattering, because we believe Mandelstam discovered Raman scattering. In reality, it happened nearly the same time. I believe he submitted his paper earlier, but Raman's paper was published slightly earlier, and Raman was a big, big promoter of his research. I mean, after getting that result on Raman scattering, it was Nature, I believe. Like within a year, he published 3-4 papers in Nature. He was a big, big promoter of his discovery, as opposed to Mandelstam. He was kind of shy guy. And so anyway, so the world now doesn't know the fact that Mandelstam independently discovered Raman scattering. But he was genius optical physicist in general. For example, he considered in quite a lot of detail this negative refractive index. So Viktor Georgievich Visilaga, whom I know very personally, and actually who is a consultant on our project, current project which we have now with the IMA Research Office on metamaterials, he published in 1967, actually, 68 is when it was translated into English, where he pointed out this fact which we discussed already. So if you make a material where both epsilon and mu negative, then refractive index becomes negative. Basically, he indicated the way how one can make materials with negative refractive index. And he also discussed in that seminal paper things like inverse Doppler effect, inverse Cherenkov effect. Because if you change the refractive index, and refractive index enters, if not most, lots of optical laws. And if you change the sign of refractive index, many effects start looking differently. Like Doppler effect, when, let's say, a source of wave approaches you, instead of blue shift normally, which you would experience, actually you would have red shift. Or let's say Cherenkov radiation, when you have electrons propagating with phase velocity larger than light speed, so the cone of radiation would go not with the electron, but against the electron. So lots of things start look differently. Yeah.
Do you think Maxwell really knew the applicability of his equations?
I don't think he really thought of that. I mean, I appreciate your question. So, I mean, if it goes down to back to 1904, maybe Maxwell knew all that. I don't think so. I mean, he was genius, but the answer is I would be very surprised. and of course, Sir John Penry. I mean, he basically brought this excitement into the field, and after him, there's so much activity around. And what he really proposed, this low-frequency plasmonic structure in 1996, remember this mesh structure which we were discussing about how to make electrical metamaterial. In 1999, he proposed how to make this magnetic metamaterial with these split-ring resonators. But perhaps the most influential paper is His paper published in 2000 in Physical Review Letters, where he said that if you have a super lens made of a material with refractive index equal minus 1, then you could get resolution beyond the wavelengths. And of course, after that, there were like 4 or 5 comments saying, "That's ridiculous. I mean, how you could publish that and all that stuff." And it took several years after that to prove that, yes, this is true, what Pendry wrote. In principle, of course, it's still not clear whether it's possible to make it in the far zone as he proposed. There is already near zone realization of that super lens. With the far zone, it's still not demonstrated, but there are very good ideas how to further develop the original idea by Pendry, and looks like it eventually will be done too. So, and as soon as recently as just in this year, a couple months, well, like 1 month ago, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, actually, he published a paper where he suggests that by using metamaterials, you can clock objects, make them invisible. So he is very, very influential in terms of metamaterials. And let's consider in more detail this metamaterial. So what's really happening in case we have negative refractive index? In conventional case, when light is incident at the interface between material with one positive refractive index and another material which has, let's say, larger positive refractive index, rays go like this. They bend toward the normal. And the reason for that is actually very simple. You have to have this longitudinal component of wave vector conserved because it is simply momentum conservation. Okay, so therefore, if refractive index is slightly larger here, it has to bend closer to the normal. So this so-called Snell's law, it's very easy to derive and it's a consequence simply of the momentum conservation. Now assume that this medium has both epsilon and mu negative, meaning that refractive index is negative. Refractive index negative means that the wave vector looks in the opposite direction toward the interface. But since you still need to conserve the longitudinal component of the momentum, the only way to, if it would go this way, there is no way you would conserve it because then the momentum wouldn't be simply conserved, because they would look in opposite direction. So the ray has to go in a different side with respect to the normal to preserve the longitudinal component. Okay, simply from the momentum conservation, it follows that the rays, instead of going this side of the normal, they would go this side of the normal. Yes?
Yeah, when I think his name is Erskrom, he gave a talk about 2 years ago, a Nobel Prize winner.
Oh, yeah, I missed that lecture.
Okay. Oh, I see. Yeah, he was talking about some causality effect, probably related to that, the arrow pointing this way from right to left.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the image start?
Mm-hmm.
What is the cause versus... Do you see that kind of...
Well, the of course, people are serious in this business. There is no any problem with violation causality here. So people looked in all details here. So Maxwell's equations indeed do allow negative refractive index. And indeed, there is no any contradiction with causality in this case. There are some very serious consequences related to the negative refractive index, which I discuss a little bit later, but no violation to causality. So the existence of negative refractive index is perfectly compatible with Maxwell's equation. So there is no any violation to causality. So, and the thing which is very easy to see, something wrong with this slide, that if both epsilon and mu are negative, that simply should indicate vectors, then E, H, and K form right-handed system. Okay, so in the pointing vector, which is a cross product of E and H, looks in the same direction as the wave vector. However, if both epsilon and mu are negative, so then the refractive index becomes negative as well, and the wave vector looks in the opposite direction. And these three vectors, K, E, H, form a left-handed system, meaning that the pointing vector and the wave vector look in the opposite direction. And that's very, 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 very unusual. So that's actually what makes this material really, really funny. So the phase propagates in the direction opposite to the flow of energy. Therefore, this material is sometimes called left-handed materials because they form this left-handed system. But that could cause some confusion, and perhaps more appropriate name for this is positive index material, this is negative index material. Well, another thing which are related to just the questions you mentioned, if you look at the energy, okay, that's the general expression for the energy. If there is no dispersion, then we come to familiar expression epsilon e squared plus mu h squared. But more general expression is like this, when you want to take into account that epsilon can depend on frequency and mu depend on the frequency. You can see right away, if both epsilon and mu are negative, the only way to keep each of these terms is positive is they have to be dispersive. They have to depend on frequency so that the derivative would be positive. The derivative has to be positive, but if you mu itself is negative, it means that there should be strong, it cannot be constant. Okay, so and that's a very important conclusion that all these negative index materials are strongly dispersive, meaning that if at this frequency you do have refractive index negative, at another frequency you might lose it because both characteristics epsilon and mu are strongly dependent on frequency. And that's a direct consequence of this negativity. So this is again illustrates the way light propagates for negative index material. You see, the ray goes like this, and it gets refracted, and it goes that side of the normal. But the phase goes this way, whereas the energy goes this way. You see, the energy, the Poynting vector, goes in this way. The phase goes in this way, and the energy goes this way. They propagate against each other, as opposed to incident light and reflected light. So, and some, there are different definitions for these materials. Sometimes people use left-handed materials. When they say left-handed, they imply that the three vectors K, H, and E form left-handed system, meaning that K and the Poynting vector propagate in opposite directions. But there are materials which are not really Trumet materials, such as photonic crystals or some waveguides, metallic waveguides, where you can have actually the situation when wave vector and Poynting vector look in opposite direction. So therefore, left-handed materials is probably the most inclusive definition, but it goes beyond these materials which I'm actually focused now on. There's also this definition negative index materials. You can have actually negative index materials even if not both epsilon and mu real parts are negative, even if only one is negative, but mu prime is different from one, you still can actually have negative refractive index. This is a necessary condition. The sufficient condition is the one which Wisselager formulated, that if both epsilon prime and mu prime are negative, then indeed refractive index is negative. But in principle, refractive index can be negative even if mu prime is positive. So, and therefore, this negative index material is, again, it's a bigger class of material. And this class of material, which is called double negative materials, where both epsilon prime and mu prime, meaning real part of epsilon mu, are both negative. Then in this case, indeed, it does belong to negative index material, and indeed, it does belong to left-handed materials. So the probably most interesting class of material, where both epsilon prime and mu prime are negative. And some perhaps the good way to call these materials is double negative materials. And I guess the time is up, so let's stop here. And so we consider we restart from this slide on Thursday. Thank you.